Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily political podcast. I'm Cindy Yu, and today I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. So the ministers are reunited with their mobile phones and the Chequers deal has been agreed upon. Katie, what is the deal that has been agreed?
So this is Theresa May's third way, and it does seem like the deal which has been agreed, and of course is just the UK side of what they want, is what leaked earlier this week in several places, which is the idea of having very close relationships with the EU. And it is a bit like the customs partnership that we talked about previously on this podcast, which is the softer of the two versions of the customs partnership and MaxVac. It's got a few different things in there, but ultimately the UK would be collecting tariffs on behalf of the EU, and we also would commit to align very closely on EU standards, including, as James revealed last week, agri-foods, so agriculture and food. And this is difficult to be accepted by Brexiteers, they're clearly not cabinet Brexiteers, because it makes doing trade deals with some countries very difficult, particularly America. But it seems so far that the cabinet all signed off on this. The only thing that we do have to bear in mind here is because all the phones were confiscated, we've only really had the number 10 side of things so far. So we've had number 10 send around photos of everyone looking all right, quite happy, and Theresa May, of course, very authoritative. We've had their account of the fact that this has been signed off, and also quite a hopeful note, I thought, where they said in the briefing paper that everyone has agreed on, they said that this is the end now of bickering about Brexit. From now on, there will be collective responsibility restored. It'd be interesting to see if that happens. There's an idea now that if you talk away, you might get sacked and move from cabinet. But what makes it tricky for people like Boris Johnson now to go and criticise the plan is they have, it seems, all agreed on it. But it would be interesting as of tomorrow and as the days go on to hear what the Brexiteers have to say about what happened in that meeting, because everyone is really wondering how they got so few concessions so far.
And James, why have the Brexiteers agreed to it?
So I think the main reason for that is that they don't have an alternative plan and they don't have the numbers. I've done a blog on Coffee House today, taking my Sun column from this morning. And basically what Boris Johnson summoned all the kind of cabinet Brexiteers, plus Gavin Williamson and Sajid Javid, who've been kind of key to the defeat of the new customs partnership and the Brexit inner cabinet, to his office on Wednesday morning. And I think that meeting actually highlighted the group's problems. First, Sajid Javid said, no, I don't want to come, because he doesn't want to look factional on Brexit. Second, Chris Grayling was there, who ran Theresa May's leadership campaign. I'm told he looked very uncomfortable with the tone of the discussion, and he then didn't come to the next meeting. Michael Gove sat there kind of muttering in Aberdonian dialect basically how dire the situation was, and basically saying, we can't just walk away, so what are we going to do? And there was talk at that meeting of coming up with an alternative Brexit plan designed to better respect the red lines that Theresa May had set out in that famous Lancaster House speech. But what happened was that they pulled back from that, partly because of a lack of time, but also because if you basically had come up with an alternative plan and presented it at Chequers, that would only work if you were all prepared to basically walk out of a government, and they weren't. I'm told at dinner last night, Boris Johnson gave a speech in which he basically said, I wasn't looking forward to today because I can count, and I knew that my side of the argument was outnumbered and we were going to lose. But, you know, now we do all have to try and sell this. And I think the big question is, what happens, as Katie said, what happens to cabinet collective responsibility when Michel Barnier comes back asking for more concessions? You know, this is the question here, because this isn't the final deal. This is the UK's opening offer in the negotiations. And I think this is where things are going to get tricky, because all of the things that Michel Barnier will demand will basically scrape away at the things that made this deal palatable to Brexiteers. So, you know, you had Theresa May talking about this parliamentary lock. So the idea that even though there'll be a common rulebook between the EU and the UK, the UK Parliament would examine each change to that rulebook and could decide whether to take it or leave it. Obviously, if it didn't adopt the change, there'd be a big impact in terms of market access. I think Michel Barnier will want something more automatic than that. You know, this is the EU's big beef with their deal with Switzerland, which is that it isn't automatic that the Swiss update their regs. Then there's obviously this question on customs, as Katie said, whether the EU will accept a third country collecting tariff revenue for them. If they demand a full customs union, that would, you know, fully remove the UK's ability to do trade deals with other people. And the third question is probably the biggest, which is free movement. I think number 10's political simple calculation is that if they can get out, if they can basically end free movement and the kind of 350 million a week figure, in inverted commas, that is sent to Brussels, most voters will see this as Brexit. How even if the UK remains in the kind of gravitational pull of the EU's regulatory field, I think most voters would think, oh, a deal that ended free movement and ended big payments to Brussels every year would count as Brexit. The question is the EU prepared to compromise on free movement?
And Katie, has Brussels said anything so far?
So we had Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator, tweet last night, and he said that he welcomed the progress made at Chequers, and basically there was a suggestion that he looked forward to seeing the detail next week when this Brexit white paper is published. Now, it wasn't saying this is a great deal, let's get going, but it did seem to me that it was probably the best Theresa May could have hoped for. It wasn't ruling anything out at first, and there doesn't seem to be that it was giving at least an encouraging sound to what Theresa May had brought her cabinet to the conclusion of. I think there's been far worse tweets, if we're going to do it over Twitter, over Brexit positions the government has held before. But I do think it's what James is touching on, which is that it's very hard to see that this is the deal that there would be. And I think a few people have said, well, actually, it looks like we're currently 80% towards the Norway model. We've got a few parts of the customs union there. And if you do get to a situation where we are Norway plus a customs union or something very similar, I think that is so unpalatable that it would be quite difficult to hold. There's also, I think there's a good example yesterday, someone suggested that people are worried that the tactics of Brussels might be to be encouraging. So even if next week Barnier is even more encouraging, that might actually fuel Brexit fears even more, because we would be, and we talked about it on this podcast yesterday, it's like getting the lobster into the pot to a point where we'll get so close to the deadline that they can just put all these awful compromises and things on us that the Britain really has no choice but to say yes. So I do think even if Brussels sound more positive, it helps Theresa May because it gets her, you know, closer on, and she's managed to convince her cabinet, but it might mean more than it does seem to mean on the surface.
But James, is the unity in cabinet quite fragile at the moment? So if Brussels comes back with something else, is that the end of the unity?
Yes, so lots of the cabinet Brexiteers take this view that their moment of maximum leverage is when Barnier comes back saying, this isn't enough, that we must have more. Their theory goes that at that point, it wouldn't be blurring. What Barnier would require and request would not be a blurring of red lines, but a much clearer crossing of them. And they think that that's their moment to say, no, we can't do this. I think the problem with that strategy is that it is twofold. One, what Theresa May agreed to in December, re the Irish border, means that if we just did a kind of Canada style trade deal with the EU, you would have to have Northern Ireland in some special status, and that would be unacceptable to a lot of Tory MPs, and certainly unacceptable to the DUP, upon whom Theresa May relies for her support in the House of Commons. Then the next problem you get onto is if you say, okay, right, let's just scrub December and let's walk away without a deal. If we walk away without a deal, everything ends on the 30th of March 2019. And even the most ardent Brexiteers in government now admit that there just isn't really enough time to get everything in place for no deal between now and then.
Mm. And Katie, so cabinet seems united, but what about the rest of the party? What do they think about this deal?
What's quite curious is so far they've been rather quiet. So we've had a few MPs, the ones you might expect, Bill Cash, famous Brexiteer, Brexit grandee. He said he's not very happy. But the ERG, so the European Research Group of Conservative backbenchers, are yet to make their bold move. No one thinks this is because Jacob Rees-Mogg thinks, oh, this sounds fine, let's go ahead. They think it's because they're calculating a move which would be the most effective to their aim, and that could be quite tricky for Theresa May. And then I also think the other slight worry for the Prime Minister is you've had Craig Oliver, David Cameron's former head of communications, take to Twitter to say that basically this is worse than EU membership, and what happened to these Brexiteers who said that people could have their cake and eat it too. And you've had a few people on the Remain side in Labour say this too, and perhaps that's predictable, but I think it does touch on the fact that what Theresa May is proposing, particularly by the end of the line, might be seen as the worst option both by Leavers and Remainers, which doesn't bode that well for electoral success.
Interestingly, I understand that on the ERG WhatsApp group last night, Jacob Rees-Mogg sent a message basically saying, we know this group leaks to blogs like Steerpike, and so so basically email me with your concerns, don't put them on the group.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And do join us again tomorrow, where Katie will be giving a roundup of the Sunday political shows. Thanks for listening. And if you enjoy this podcast, do subscribe, rate and review. And for a limited time now, you can try a month of The Spectator online for free in our summer sale. Go to spectator.co.uk/summer to start your free trial today.